just opened. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 886 directs the Department of Human Services to establish at least one pilot program that integrates faith-based and community organizations into the provision of human services by the department. You have a dash one amendment from Senator Shields, and I just want to let you know this bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means at this time.
Okay, and I will open the public hearing. Frank, Senator Shields, did you want to?
In a few minutes, Brian, I'll have copies of this for everybody. Okay. I'm sorry. You have in front of you the dash one amendments, which we created to address lots of people's concerns and interests and so on. But my staff did a wonderful job of kind of. What would you call this? Fancy hand engrossing the bill so you can see where each and every change occurs.
Okay.
But essentially, there is a whereas that says, whereas the Department of Human Services recognizes the benefit from the work of small nonprofit mentoring groups and groups such as court-appointed special advocate voucher advocate volunteer program, the department does not take a position on any belief system or view of any faith-based or community organizations. And then it continues with the now, therefore, in the bill. There's a reason for this, okay? And I'm just trying to explain the reason for everybody real quickly, and that is that lately there have been some difficulties with volunteers that kind of go beyond the scope of what a volunteer ought to be doing, and you can end up in this kind of a litigious society with some lawsuits. And so there's a little bit of distancing there that I think is okay and is appropriate. Okay? Then there's a couple places where it talks about the department may not require a client to participate in the activities or services of a faith-based or community-based organization. Just kind of reiterating, you know, that's it. And then another place it says the department may not initiate any volunteer activities of faith-based or community-based organizations to assist human services clients. Again, this is separation of church and state stuff. Mm-hmm. Is that all clear? A third issue I'd bring up would be kind of under the paragraph where it says the department shall develop procedures and training to assist staff in identifying clients who have an existing affiliation with a faith-based or community-based organization who have an interest in working with the organization to supplement the services provided by the department. And now that I've been reading them, hand them to everybody. Okay? This, as you're looking at this, this is just an easy way of reading the bill.
Okay?
And it has each of those changes underlined. Okay? So, the only one left is one that I have listed as number four. It would be right in the middle of the second page, and it's crosses out all that stuff about coordinating services, and it talks instead of about assisting an interested client in contacting a faith-based or community organization with whom the client is affiliated and communicating the needs of the client to the organization. All of this is just the kind of buffer stuff that I was very comfortable with to make sure we don't run amok anything that looks, acts, walks, talks, smells like separation of church-state issues. Okay? I know that you have some testimony, and so since a lot of these changes came in response to the Department of Human Services concerns, I would hope you would let the representative from the Department of Human Services maybe do some testimony and maybe address some of that the stuff that I've just talked about.
Okay. Michael Buckley?
I Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Buckley. I'm the acting assistant administrator for self-sufficiency and child safety for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 886 in its amended form. I think as Senator Shields explained, this bill would require the department to establish a pilot program in at least a minimum a single service delivery area for the purposes of coordinating service delivery for commonly served clients. And by our definition, commonly served clients would be obviously a client of the department, but also a client that may have an existing relationship with a faith-based or community-based organization. I think some of the keys here is under this concept, the department would inquire of clients who have an existing relationship with a faith-based or community-based organization whether they have an interest in a referral for services that, and for my way of thinking, a key word here is to complement the DHS service plan. So that is not to say that either the faith or community-based organization would necessarily be drawn in to the development of the department's service plan and service strategy, but a referral for complementing services. An example could be a mentor. And then the other key is working out with identified organizations what coordination and complementary services really mean, or what would be in the context of this pilot. There are some areas of concern in regard any time the department attempts to coordinate services with organizations. Those two primary areas of concern are safeguarding confidentiality of client information and ensuring that clients are not referred to organizations that they don't really want to work with. And we feel that this bill in its amended form does not create any concerns in those two areas. This bill would not require the department to provide access to department records, provide access to community organizations on department records, and its participation on the part of the participant are voluntary and only with the organizations of which they have an existing relationship with. And obviously part of our process is to try to determine and when we're interviewing clients if they have an existing relationship with an organization, faith-based or community-based, and what their level of interest would be in getting a referral for complementary kinds of services. Coordinating service delivery with community-based organizations is a fairly common part of our business. We do it routinely in any number of areas. We believe that this bill could provide the department with a framework that could further improve that coordination efforts.
Okay. Could you give me an example of some of the faith-based groups that you're currently working with?
Well, I think I could give you several examples. It is not uncommon for faith-based organizations to collect resources for newborns and provide that to new moms with new children. Those resources can often be clothes, blankets. They can also be referrals for counseling. But a project that we worked on about a year ago it was a little more formal. And the purpose of that was to establish mentors for clients who had an interest in having a mentor from a faith-based organization.
Now, can you name the names of the faith-based organizations that you're working with?
Sorry. Well, we've had formal contracts with like Catholic Community Services in the Eugene area for 15, 20 years.
Okay.
Lutheran Family Services is another organization, I think, in the Portland area that we have. St. Vincent de Paul has been a formal contractor for us in both Portland and Eugene for a long time.
Good. Thank you. I'm it's still kind of boggling my mind why we're even talking about this, because I know that those contacts are traditional. I've been on the board of St. Vincent de Paul. Mm-hmm. They get money from the state. They get money from the feds. They do good work in all areas, Catholic community services, a variety of...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think our relationship with organizations such as Catholic Community Services or St. Vincent, they are service providers, mm-hmm. and they've gone through a competitive process. That they're in the business of providing services. Although they have a faith-based philosophical premise, they nevertheless they are in the business to provide social services, and we contract with them in the nature of that business.
And I understand the separation between the religious aspect of the organization and their charitable aspect, which is required by the feds and the state in order to get the money that they get. I understand that.
That's correct, Senator.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
You don't have currently a list of organizations that have resources that are available to clients potentially. And let me give you an example of a domestic violence victim. Do you have a list of, say, faith-based organizations that might be able to provide temporary shelter on a assuming that the client volunteers and wants to participate, or might have clothing?
Senator Minnis, I may not have a central list, but within each community, and we could certainly compile that if you wish. But
no, I guess I was wondering if you actually did have that.
Fairly routinely, and that's part of what I was referring to in terms of the department's been coordinating service delivery in communities for quite some time. And your example is an excellent example, because it's more often than not we will have developed these kind of relationships with domestic violence service providers, which we consider community-based organizations, and it's very common for us to coordinate services when we're serving common clients.
Right, Mr. Chairman, let me give you an example. As a sex crimes detective at the Portland Police Bureau, I do rape victim interviews at OHSU, and I've had experience of having a victim who has no place to go.
Yes.
And when you call the women's shelters in the Portland area, there's no room.
You're full.
They say, we're full, we don't have any room, we can't take anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not taking them home with me. So, you know, what ends up happening is they end up sitting or, you know, sleeping in one of the operatories, exam mm-hmm. rooms at OHSU until somebody can come get them. I guess my vision for where we might be able to go here with this kind of a concept is that organizations that are willing to step up and provide these kind of services might be available, and that if the person has an opportunity and the providers, the workers, know that they're available, then all they have to do is say, these are some options for you. It's your choice. We can make a call if you want or not. And at least have options to the service. It works in the community policing model, particularly with domestic violence and, you know, sexual assault cases and this kind of stuff. So,
Senator Miss, sometimes what is simply lacking is infrastructure. The resources are out there, not necessarily connected in an organized way. And something like this bill might be able to help along that direction.
Thank you. Senator Stark.
Yes, I've mentioned before when we had this bill up about Vision West in Washington County and their efforts to involve the faith community in a variety of ways. It was initiated by the county, mm-hmm. but they brought together members of all faiths. I think we look at separation of church and state, we're primarily talking about separation of church and Christianity. I mean state and Christianity, not generally so involved with other faiths, but there's many faiths in all communities, and in Washington County large numbers of all faiths have come together there. They're getting some tutorial from the county, but they're stepping up in a wide variety of ways to provide services, drug delivery of services, more on an individual volunteer basis than organizationally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a place where we fail miserably is to recruit volunteers. And we were blessed in our local church to have Washington County coordinator come to our church and explain to people what kind of volunteer opportunities were available where they might make a contribution to their neighbors. And I think that this is gaining momentum. So I'm wondering in what way would this bill affect the operation of that initiative that's already ongoing?
Well, it's certainly, it certainly could build upon those kind of things that are already in existence, and it could actually help by bringing a little more infrastructure. It's not uncommon for the department to sign up through our volunteer program. And we've done that before, not necessarily always with faith-based organizations, but it could certainly help in terms of help organizing, providing a little more infrastructure for coordination, for training for issues around poverty as an example, and just the kind of common problems that families living in poverty face, so that those that are in fact interested in volunteering have a little more basis in terms of the background, in terms of the families and individuals that they're going to be working with.
Thank you. Of course, we have many issues around the human service delivery. Seems to me that mental health and drug and alcohol are real opportunities for volunteerism to make a difference. And so I'm hopeful that this bill will provide the framework so that we can reach out to the greater faith community and let them know of the volunteer opportunities that are available.
Mentors are not a common component in a lot of the department services, but mentor programs have been demonstrated to be very effective, particularly with younger participants.
Thank you.
Senator Shields.
I just wanted to follow up on Senator Starr's comment. I have some testimony from a gentleman by the name of Lowell Greathouse. He works for the United Way of the Columbia Willamette in Portland. And I'd just like to make it available to the committee. He has sat in on the meetings in Washington County that Senator Starr has been talking about and is well aware of what those meetings have done. So I just wanted to point that out. Mr. Chairman,
yes.
if it would be kosher by you, in proceeding, I don't know whether you want to think about the Dash 1 amendments or whether you would like to listen to Mr. Green, who I've known for a long time. Steve Green works with the Law Commission, and in the last session, the 30 senators in this legislative body asked the Law Commission to do some research related to separation of church and state. And for that reason, he's come today, and he might have a little bit of a couple suggestions that make sure that we stay out of that sticky wicket.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I will not hear Stephen Green, but I will call Andrea Meyer from ACLU to keep Stephen Green honest.
Yeah.
Steve Green. Yes. Andrea, come up together, please. Because I understand that you both have some concerns that are parallel and could be fixed, perhaps. Mr. Green, if you would introduce yourself, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Stephen Green. I'm a professor of law at Willamette University College of Law. My area of expertise is constitutional law, and specifically in First Amendment law, church and state matters. I have done work on issues of faith-based initiatives, charitable choice as it's called, for about 7-8 years, most of it in Washington, D.C., before I lived before coming here. And for the last year, I've been working with the Oregon Law Commission on a study of the faith-based initiative as it's applied here in Oregon. Hopefully, we'll be able to return to that now that classes are finished and get something written up. Let me just begin by saying that as someone who's written in this area and studied it for several years. I want to commend Senator Shields for his leadership in this area. He really has been out front in trying to do, I think, very good work and trying to be very sensitive to all the needs and concerns that exist on all sides of this issue, helping those people who are in need, but also being sensitive to the constitutional issues that do exist and that have many times kind of been the focal point of some of the more heated debate that we've seen in Washington, D.C. over these. As a result, I'm here, actually, let me just say, I'm here in my individual capacity as a law professor. I'm not here representing the Oregon Law Commission, even though I am working on this study. As a result, I don't take a position on this bill one way or the other, but I do want to commend Senator Shields for the effort that's existed here, and I've been in some meetings on this previously. And just start out by saying that I think that this bill has been refined in a way to avoid certainly most of the constitutional concerns that exist. This is not a bill that provides funding for public funding for religious institutions, so you don't have those funding concerns under the Establishment Clause, either the state Establishment Clause or the federal Establishment Clause. As a result of no funding, you also are not going to have the same kind of employment discrimination concerns that exist under the what was the pending federal bill that caused a lot of concern. Those concerns still may exist in private context, but they're not going to be take place under this particular bill. I think the amendments that Senator Shields has made to this more recently, and then the comments of Michael Buckley about this, are very well taken, and I think this bill has been refined and is trying to avoid many of those problems. The concerns that I have, both as a constitutional scholar and just as being a lawyer, are some things that I think are just going to probably have to be worked out by DHS, by the Attorney General's office. I mean, you always have concerns about the impressions that the state is potentially sponsoring or endorsing the activity that the religious organization may be offering up. There are always going to be potential kind of liability concerns that may exist there, and that is something that I think as a result of this bill is not setting up any kind of permanent or any kind of formal relationship with these organizations, but that is something that I think always needs to be made known. There are those confidentiality concerns that have been mentioned. I think there are concerns that there may be an impression of the client, some type of quid pro quo that may exist, in essence, that you have this coordination with either the faith-based or the community-based organization, and they make some recommendation back that you need to go through a certain type of program or services, and then the client feeling that the state is somehow putting its stamp of approval on that, and if they don't complete the requirement that the faith-based organization may say is necessary, then they may feel that their benefits may hinge on that. And so this needs to be made very clear to the client about that. There's some of the provisions in the law that I think already account for that. I've just written up real quickly, and I apologize, I just did it today because I was out of town. I intended to get this to Senator Shields' office sooner. But I just made some suggestions on some, and I'll call them amendments if you wish, that potentially just Section 1, Subsection 3, that I think it might be helpful to provide a little bit more defined notice provision here. And I just, for lack of a better place to put it, recommended at the very end of subsection 3 to add something that says, it would continue with saying, and the department shall provide notice to the client of their rights under this law, including the ability not to participate in faith-based community organization and to disengage that relationship at any time.
Yes, Senator.
Senator Minnis.
I want to ask Mr. Green a question regarding that issue, because when you raise issues of provide notice, I'm a policeman.
Mm-hmm.
Advise people of their constitutional rights, remain silent.
Mm-hmm.
Do so verbally. Were I assuming talking about a written notice or a written form of some sort?
I'm not sure exactly what procedures the department uses at this point. I don't think written notice is necessary. That'd be something in writing.
And that's the point I wanted to get to. That when if you talk about providing notice, this may be as simple as a caseworker or whomever saying to this person in a prescribed form. And I would suggest they probably actually should have something that they have prescribed that says you do, in fact, have the privilege of not accessing the services. It's your choice. You can do it freely and voluntarily, et cetera. But that if they don't provide some kind of written form, that they actually have a notation in their file that they've been given that notice.
You're reading my mind. I was going to say suggest that same thing. I was going to say I don't think it has to be written, but I think it should be documented in the record somewhere that they have actually provided the client with the notice. And to a degree, the reason I'm suggesting this this comes back from some prior experience I had. Some of the original charitable choice bills that went through Congress that have been enacted into law now, even though they provided into law the opportunity for the client to have a non-religious provider, they did not have in the law, they do not, and actually currently the first two ones, do not have in the law any requirement that you notify the client that they have the opportunity to have a non-religious provider. And I think that's important. And so it's just to clarify that not only, as it says in the bill itself, that that they are notified that they were not severely, they were not adversely impact the client's eligibility, that this makes sure that this is made known to that client, that it will not in any way affect that, and that also at any time that the client wishes to say, I want to disengage with my faith-based organization, that they know that they can do that. Secondarily, speaking of disengagement, that would be the other thing that I don't see actually exists in this bill. And I realize this bill has been refined, and so to a certain extent it's not the same way that it was written a little bit earlier, where it was more of a coordinating services. This would be under subsection 4A. It used to, as you can see, say coordinating services with the department, and now it's more or less just assisting the client in contacting the faith-based organization. So there can be some type of coordination of services. But still, I think it would be good for the bill to have something that would be clearly indicating that the department can disengage this relationship with the faith-based organization if the client so requests, but also if the activities or services provided by the faith-based organization may in some ways end up being inconsistent with the department's goals, procedures, or their ability to effectively provide services to that client. It's just poised there's that
Senator,
potential.
Senator Shields.
Yeah, you've got me a little confused, Steve. You here suggested it is a subsection 6 of section 1,
mm-hmm.
and yet just now you said to put it under paragraph 4. And
it's just purely a suggestion, Senator. I'm saying it was implicated by subsection 4. It potentially could fit under there, or it may need to be a freestanding just to indicate that it is, when they're talking about disengagement, it's applying to the entire bill and not just to that particular subsection. So that's the reason when I just initially thought of it, it should be a freestanding subsection.
So you don't have a preference
whether it's under
4 or independent subsection 6.
Yes.
Okay.
And then just the other thing, even though once again, as I said several times already, this bill has been refined already, the other concern that I had expressed to Senator Shields in the past might be the situation I could see potentially occurring where the overture is made by the department to a client, we will contact your faith-based or community organization if you would like. Then there may be some expectation that may arise in the part of the client that the department is in fact going to coordinate services and go forward with, in essence, coordinating with the faith-based organization, community organization. And I would just suggest it might be clear just to ensure, even though I think Michael Buckley is completely correct, this does not create any type of entitlement to services in the client, but potentially, just to clarify things, that should be put into the law, that this does not create an entitlement for services, or supplemental services. I think that's the way the bill had been written.
Supplemental services,
yeah, in the client, just so it does not bind the department. If they do engage in some type of coordinated services or referral with a religious or community-based organization, that the client can then demand that they follow through with what otherwise might be inconsistent programmatic activity. Those would be the primary recommendations.
Senator Minnis.
Andrea has additional comments to make in addition to Mr. Green. My first question is, do you have additional comments and suggestions in addition to Mr. Green's?
Not suggestions. Comments.
Okay. Because I want to raise my issues now,
okay.
and since we have a constitutional scholar here. And the issue,
the lawyer.
I know she routinely advises me that she's not a constitutional scholar, but the issue I would like to raise is the department's potential discrimination against a religious or a faith-based organization, and I would suggest that we have some language in the bill that says that the department may not discriminate against a faith-based organization that is otherwise qualified, so long as they meet the goals and objectives and this kind of thing. I can just envision, you know, one particular group saying we were denied access. And we couldn't, we were not allowed to provide services, and they're discriminated against us. Well, I don't think that's the intent, but I think the department should have within its purview the ability to set certain standards and qualifications. I think in the bill it talks mm-hmm. about, you know, groups that are not functioning consistent with the goals of the agency. So there's got to be some qualification or expectation on behalf of those people that participate, but they ought not also be allowed to discriminate against one particular group or another, if you will. And that, I mean, I say that because I think that it's that's what our Constitution generally compels, that we not discriminate.
I think you're exactly right. I think there's a tension that exists here, though. And actually, one thing that the most recent revision from Senator Shields provides, now that I look at it, maybe causes a little concern. In subsection 1, the new language says, on the second sentence, the purpose of the program is to provide an opportunity for faith-based community organizations. That seems to imply that it is for the benefit of the faith-based and community organizations. And, of course, the purpose of this type of law is for the benefit of the clients, for them to access services. We wouldn't want to create the impression also that the faith-based and community organizations have any entitlement themselves in this.
Right.
I think the bottom line should be between the client, what the client needs, and then also what is within the treatment plan, if you want to use that term, that the Department of Human Services is creating. I agree with you, Senator Minnis. We do not want to have discrimination against faith-based organizations because some of them may not be mainstream, may not be whatever.
Well, wouldn't the department have the ability to determine what programs the faith, a particular faith-based group, the value of the program they offer?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they would, I think they would look at the shelter program, and they would look at the list of people who provide shelter programs, and they would look at some of the background information and the criteria and so on and so forth to make that judgment. They wouldn't have to send someone somewhere unless they knew pretty much what they were into, right?
Well, that's why I think it's clear. It needs to be clear that this is not creating an entitlement in the client or in the faith-based or community organization, because I think the department is going to have to be the final arbiter of whether this is our services that are consistent. I think that there's always going to be the potential, because you could see theoretically a client coming in and saying, "I want you to contact my faith-based organization." The faith-based organization comes up with something that is 180 degrees. From what DHS suggests is the appropriate services, and what the faith-based organization is suggesting is something that's very much, you know, grounded on their tenets and teachings. If that is then rejected, that is going to create the impression of potential discrimination. And so I'm not sure how you police that, other than that that potential is always going to exist.
Okay, good. Thank you. Senator? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I was a little worried about that, too. Senator Minnis used a term about something or other with maybe diverse from what their goals and ideas are. I looked in the bill. I don't see anything that says anything about it being in opposite.
I think on page 2, line 21, the department may not require a client to participate in the activities or services of faith-based community organizations. Well, hang on a second. Hang on, what is that? Where is it? Maybe I imagined this.
I didn't see it in either amendment.
Yeah, I may have just read it into it as I was reading the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, that bothered me just a bit, because what the gentleman here is saying right now, in a way, it bothers me, because I've seen the time when I felt we ought to go about 180 degrees from what the recommendations had been in the operation that had been happening at the state level. And so I would not want to be involved in just carte blanche saying that we would be backing necessarily the goals of an agency, but that these would be something that would be things that reasonable people would do or something to that effect, because I've certainly seen times when if the way they handled the situation was the way their goals are, I certainly would be the first one to disagree with those goals.
Well, Senator, I think the point is that neither side is perfect or has perfect knowledge in all situations. I have seen some cases out there. I was testifying just on Friday in the Vermont Senate in a hearing dealing with clergy reporting issues under sexual abuse issues. And there have been several cases out there where there have been situations where there's been a sexual abuse situation. The church tries to handle it, and they start doing a particular procedure that is 180 degrees and is inconsistent with family and youth services. They want to keep the family together when the abuse is still ongoing or something like this because of their religious tenets and teachings. And so there is that potential for that type of tension that may exist sometimes. And I guess what I'm saying is I think it's important that the bottom line is the department has to have that judgment over whether the value of the services, as Senator Morris has said, are consistent in a way that is not judgmental of any particular religious belief system, but still that it is, you know, consistent with what they're doing. Now, if they feel it's inconsistent, then they break off the relationship. That doesn't mean that the client can't continue to receive its ministering from the faith community. But I think there's going to be a point where the state may be required sometimes to kind of disengage or disassociate itself with particular service activity that a religious organization may come up with if it is just completely inconsistent with what the agency is doing. And to a degree, that's why I suggested this this amendment that I said is subsection 6.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just by way of illustration, often in situations of child abuse or interference, there's a nutritional problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see some great differences in the beliefs of some religions over diet and nutritional methods and eating habits and things like that. We have some, I think, very fine people involved and very what I would highly religions with high rating of integrity that would differ quite a little bit on some of their dietary habits, and things like that could pose a real problem if someone would automatically say, well, because you don't follow this diet or that diet or something like this, why, we're not going to use you.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to, you know, you can't write everything in the bill, but how do you get it to where there's some limitations without regard to goals or this kind of thing in there that you can protect those issues and allow people to have at least a certain amount of latitude in there.
Well, Senator, as I said, I think if you would include this provision that I recommended, that it at least allows the department to disengage the relationship that it has created, if we have to, yeah, we have to rely on the department's judgment. They're the experts when it comes to whether certain procedures or practices are going to be consistent with what is needed for these people. So long as, and I don't think the department's going to do this, but so long as the department does not in any way disparage that particular faith community, and the decision may end up being between the client and their spiritual advisor about whether they can continue to receive the services from the department or not. But the department not be making those decisions. All it's saying is, we're going to no longer recommend this, or we're no longer going to coordinate this. If you want to continue on your own, you can, but we cannot be engaged in that.
Okay. Good. Thank you. We're going to have to move along, Senator.
Well, I know where I read the issue, Senator Fisher. It's in that second suggestion you had, the disengagement.
Section clause. 1, subsection 6.
Yeah. Okay. The other, there's nothing in the bill that specifically says that the department can accept gifts or grants. And I would suggest that perhaps they ought to be able to do that. In other words, if you have a church organization that says, is it in there? Where is that?
Oh, in section 2.
Section two.
Yes. Second sentence. Okay, I'm sorry. Except contributions of funds. Okay, I'm sorry. Forgive me. I'll scratch that suggestion.
Okay, Senator. Yes, Senator.
One of the things that you could say to get around some of this is in his section 1, subsection 6 suggestion, you know, the department shall disengage, and maybe you can just insert a couple words, without prejudice. you know, the department shall disengage without prejudice any relationship, you know, with a faith-based or community organization under this section, if, and then it has two illustrations. I'm just trying to make it easier. The other thing I wanted to say, and I was listening carefully to Senator Fisher and Senator Minnis at this point, this is a pilot project. We're trying to do this to find out what works and what doesn't work, you know, and so, you know, we're not going to have everything nailed down before we start even a pilot.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'm going to move along, and we'll hear from Andrea, and then I know Philip Kennedy Long wants to testify, but we're going to amend this bill. We're going to come back, and we have another hearing that I want to make sure we have enough time to do. So, Andrea, could you introduce yourself? And
I'll get it right this time. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, and I will be brief, and I do want to thank Senator Shields for all his work and for bringing us into the conversation, and I certainly appreciate the intent and the goals here, as Mr. Green articulated as well. We are still concerned, and I think some of that has been discussed already as to why we're still concerned. And one of the issues that I think these amendments by Mr. Green start to address is a bit of our concern that clients will feel coerced or pressured to be involved in a faith-based or community organization. In addition, you know, sort of a cautionary to the department, I appreciate that the language membership is not in here, it's affiliation. For instance, members, Muslims do not necessarily have membership in their mosque, and such. We wouldn't want them to be excluded because they don't have proof of membership per se, because it's not a membership that they affiliate or are connected with mosques, but don't have what we might, or some communities where they actually join and pay dues and affiliate and have membership in a particular house of worship. So we certainly would want sensitivity by the department into a broad understanding of what affiliation means, and obviously we will look to what the pilot project does and the results and the report. In addition, I think it's also very important, as Mr. Green has recommended, that the department be able to sever the relationship if it's not meeting the goals. And the language in his draft amendments are acceptable to us. Okay. That concludes.
Thank you. One of the things that came to mind when you were talking in the Eugene Springfield area, various churches are open for a period of say 2 weeks for homeless people to stay overnight in that particular church. I don't see any affiliation with that church. So I mean, if you're going to go to the Methodist church to stay overnight, I don't know that would, if people would view that as, you know, they're given a choice. And I guess my question would be that if a person went in and said, well, the question, are you affiliated? Well, sometimes. Give me the choices. Let me see what you have on the menu. And you may say, oh, okay, I want to go to Catholic Community Services because they have food baskets. Catholic Community Services already have food baskets, and so I don't. Is it possible for a person to, do they have to be affiliated? Can't they say, gee, the Methodists have a great program. I would like to go to the shelter program for abused women. They do that anyway, right? Or could they under this program?
Well,
according to your...
The law just doesn't speak to that, Senator. I believe that DHS could already, in fact, to a certain extent, this law is probably unnecessary. I think DHS could probably do all of this. But maybe gives them the impetus to do it more, I'm not sure. But I think DHS, even though it would not be provided specifically in this law, because this is talking about people who already have some type of existing affiliation with a particular faith group or community-based organization, there's nothing that prohibits DHS from making a referral to a someone who is a non-member. And I know Catholic Social Services, Catholic Charities, is legend for accepting anyone who walks through the door and ministering to all people, as many organizations are. And so they're not.
But you would not refer people to the mission, because the mission requires that you participate in their religious service, or would
you? I think this bill implies that the services that the faith-based, and here we are talking about faith-based organization, is going to be providing will probably be faith-infused. They will have a religious component to them. They may not always, but they may have a faith-infused component.
That's why you're here, right? Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
The crux of the issue is it's voluntary.
It's
freely and voluntarily given, and that the person can disengage or be disengaged if, in fact, they choose not to, and that there's notice and that they're aware of it. They have a cognizance that they can disengage. I think that's the main issue.
Right. Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, I mean, there may be those who say I'm affiliated or whatever. I would like this particular house of worship, in this case, to be, I'd like to work with this pastor. And they may not be fully cognizant of some of the religious tenets or suggestions or recommendations that might be made to them. And at any point, if they begin to feel uncomfortable, that those put them at risk, or that they're just, that doesn't work with their services, what they need, then they should feel free. And we really want to empower people also to feel free to say, I appreciate that. I'm not comfortable with that. I want to continue maintaining my services from DHS, and I want to disengage.
And Mr. Chairman, that's a very important. Two things I want to say. I know your tolerance is running out. I think it is very important, particularly when you're dealing with populations who are in need, because, again, as a detective who does sex crimes investigations, it's very important to empower the victim. It's an important part of that, so that's important part of what you said. I want to go back to an issue Mr. Green raised on the purpose of the program, make some suggested language. Mm-hmm. Section 1, line 12, it should say something like, the purpose of the program is to provide an opportunity for clients to access faith-based or community organizations that take part in the effort to assist human service clients who are affiliated with those organizations. So it is client-oriented, because I think that's what we're trying to get to.
Can you get that to me?
Yeah, I'll get that to you. And I want to make one other suggestion, because I think it's an important point. The most important part of this bill, as far as I'm concerned, is the training component that could be provided by DHS to many of these organizations. Because, again, as I've worked in sex abuse cases and child sexual abuse cases and even homicide cases, oftentimes many religious organizations do not have a good understanding of some of the dynamics that are ongoing in the issues that they're dealing with. And child abuse is one of the areas that I would cite most frequently. There's a perception among some people that the government's out to get them, so to speak, and they want to take their children away. But when you actually delve into these issues, you'll find that it really is quite the opposite. And in fact, the workload is overwhelming. So I want to at least put out on the table on line 8 on page 3, where it talks about the training may include instruction about issues of poverty that we might consider also including domestic violence, child abuse and sexual abuse. And the reason for that, I think there's a tremendous benefit for pastors and lay pastors and other persons to have a better understanding of some of the social dynamics that exist in those environments. Because I have seen from time to time some of the folks in the religious community, well-meaning, who have messed up some cases by doing some interesting things. So I think the training is probably the most important component.
Okay. We're going to end this public hearing shortly, yes.
I wanted to respond to Senator Minnis only by saying that I think at the moment we have a fiscal that says zero on it, and I don't want that to change with, you know, too much high-priced training.
Well, it's May.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
May.
Okay.
It's only April, but we're getting to May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one of the huge untapped resources is people who have time for volunteerism, and that this benefit for delivery of services is one that goes beyond, or should go beyond, the faith-based organization itself, but to the members of such faith-based organizations who would volunteer their time apart from, not sponsored by, the faith-based community. And if we can't reach that level of participation, we've missed a huge, huge resource. Independent living, Meals on Wheels, all kinds of opportunities that should be addressed, could be addressed by volunteerism, and are being so today to some extent. But I think we've got a huge untapped resource out there.
Thank you.
Chair Morissette, Senator Starr, in the meeting with Senator Shields, I remember someone from the department talking about that and the ongoing need and desire to do that. I think there may be some funding or other issues that have had an effect, but I certainly understood a real commitment to that, and I'm sure they'd be happy to follow up with you.
Okay. Thank you. Peter, Philip, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm sorry. And you will have an opportunity to close the public hearing. We're going to amend the bill. We'll bring it back. We'll have another work session. Hearing, and then move. That's the plan. Yes.
Quick comment. I'm just asking the committee to provide me. Senator Minnis gave me his suggestion. Yeah. I've got Steve Green's suggestions. Anybody else that has suggestions, please get them. Okay?
Okay. Thank you. Okay. We will open the public hearing. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 684.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 684 prohibits adding a substance to a water system unless that substance improves potability, has been tested and approved as safe and effective by the Federal Food and Drug Administration, or contains no contaminants that exceed certain public health standards. You have a number of documents that have been provided by several people. There's one packet that's highlighted that will be discussed by Gordon Martin. Another packet from Oregon Citizens for Safe Drinking Water that's clipped together. And then another packet of letters, starting with a letter from Representative Alan Bates. And you have another paperclip packet of letters.
Okay.
And a notebook from, I believe, the Oregon Dental Association. Or at least it starts with the Oregon Dental Association.
Okay.
So, yep. Plenty of paper.
At least I got the pretty color notebook.
I did too.
Okay. Now, what's the name? Okay. Gordon Martin, would you please come forward? And William Ken Paz, please come up. Well, let's see. Why don't you be seated, Gordon, and we will discuss format. Would you prefer to make your separate presentation?
I think that would be appropriate. I'm not sure who the other person is.
Okay. So. I would like to have an opportunity to have some exchange of views. I mean, I don't want to put you necessarily at a disadvantage of going first and not being able to respond if they are going to respond to you. So you will have an opportunity to respond to the person who follows you, and then there will be questions.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Reset and committee. My name is Gordon Martin. I'm a resident in Tigard. And I've been asked to testify here in front of you by the Citizens for Safe Drinking Water, not to be confused with Citizens for Safe Water, which I am a member of. I was kind of brought into this about 5 months ago, and then just recently Citizens for Safe Drinking Water asked me to testify because Lynn Campbell, who has presented you with a lot of information and has been talking with you and your aides, she thought a new face with a new perspective might be appropriate at this time, since we're trying now to get this into an interim committee for further review because we've just run out of time for full hearings and so forth. So I don't pretend to be an expert on the bill or on fluoridation and water systems, but I have been involved with water-related projects here for about the last 4 years. Maybe a little history of my background, and then I can hit some of the comments that I've outlined in my topics that I'd like to raise. About 4 years ago, many of you probably heard Tigard was going to work towards putting Willamette River water into their system, and I felt real uncomfortable with that issue and started investigating. That led to an initiative petition in Tigard, which I helped circulate and coordinate. It passed by an 87% margin. Then Tualatin asked us for our help. Sherwood asked us, excuse me, for our help, and Wilsonville. And so initiative petitions started circulating in all those areas, and they all passed by in the 70% to 80% range. And so we figured we were doing something right. And those initiatives basically changed the city charter in those municipalities, requiring a vote of the people before Willamette Water, treated Willamette Water, could be put into the system. I know this is a little bit away from the bill itself, but I think maybe a little perspective of where I'm coming from might be helpful. We have been growing the Citizens for Safe Water, not drinking water, safe water, has been growing here the last 4 years, and we've been involved in other areas besides Willamette River treated water. During this whole process, and I won't detail out all the different involvements, but it became evident that in the Tualatin Valley Water District, we could not really effectively do an initiative because that isn't Tualatin Valley Water District is not a municipality, therefore it doesn't have a charter. So they run by ordinances that can be changed daily. And so someone said, well, why don't you volunteer and run for a board position? So I did, against a 17-year incumbent, and won by almost a 90% margin, going in with the idea of trying to protect the citizens in the district, which I am a customer of, from drinking Willamette River water. So when I got there, I kind of figured, oh, well, this will be my issue, and this is why I'm here. But then things start cropping up that really startled me. And since my appointment to the board almost 2 years ago, I've had 37 different agenda items which I proposed to the board for investigation, which is double all of the proposed agenda items for the entire rest of the board. One of those issues happened to be fluoridation. And that's when I started working with Lynn Campbell. She's with Citizens for Safe Drinking Water. And she started telling me what was going on in the fluoridation area. And so this is just one more issue that really needed to be investigated. During that investigation, I started, as you would, going through due diligence and trying to find out what I could about the issue, only to learn that our district is split up and is fluoridating about two-thirds of it based on a vote that happened back in 1960s when there was only 5,000 to 8,000 customers. We have about 180,000 customers now. We service Sherwood with about 15,000 people. So we're the second largest water district in the state, behind Portland, of course. So I said, this needs some more examination. So I prevailed upon the board to have a public hearing. Well, that opened up Pandora's box. We had over 130 people attend with 3.5 hours of testimony from 47 different people, resulting in 500 pages of documentation from both the proponents and the opponents. And so now I'm going from the first grade level of knowledge to the second grade level of knowledge. During this process, I've discovered that we are putting unapproved chemicals in our water system here in the district. Mm-hmm. But it happens that the third of the district that isn't fluoridated, which is the part of the district that I live in, it doesn't have any fluoridation, so it was never really a concern. And so even in our own district, we don't have consistency. So we are just looking at alternatives, and it would have been great to have a bill like 684, which essentially says that if a substance is going to be added to a water system, it needs to be approved and added to the water system for medical purposes. It needs to be approved, tested and approved by the FDA. I, coming into this, I would have thought that that was the case, but I'm just amazed that it isn't. So then I learned, excuse me, that the fluoride that we put into our water system is industrial grade. It contains contaminants and lead and arsenic, for example, which exceed our maximum concentration level goals. This industrial grade fluoride it hasn't been studied by the FDA and or the EPA. So I'm saying, oh my goodness, what's going on here? We're pumping fluoride into our water systems, and we really don't know what effect it has. Is it safe for our consumers? So this resulted in discussions amongst the board members, and we have a wide range of board members with different ideas. But for example, one of the board members lived in a fluoridated community for her entire life, but she has tooth fluorosis on six or more of her teeth. But she doesn't have cavities, but she has to deal with the fluorosis problem. She has chronic fatigue syndrome. We don't know if that's part of the fluoridation, but she suspects it. But after all that, she believes that fluoridation, under the proper guidelines and dosages, does prevent tooth decay. But she doesn't know what to do because we don't have established criteria for deciding what to do. That is the problem. And if we did, my job would be easy. If we had a uniform statewide regulation that basically says what this bill is proposing, if we had that, we would still probably have the hearings and find out what the people think, but we could show this to the people and say, until this fluoride is approved by the FDA and it is certain that it is effective and it's safe, we can't put it in the water. Right now, the FDA and the EPA don't have these studies. They haven't been done by anyone. The FDA considers fluoride a drug. We all kind of assume if it's a drug, it's been tested and approved. It hasn't. So we have some real inconsistencies in what we're doing. And I'm lost on really what to do, because I know that mass application of fluoride through the water system isn't proper because we cannot follow a dose recommendation because every child is going to get a different dose. So what do we do? Do we quit fluoridating the water? Well, the board, unless we have a viable alternative, isn't going to buy off on that. So I'm forced as a board member now to kind of reinvent the wheel and come up with a proposal for the board that, one, gives a dosage to the children and also gives the people that don't want fluoride in their water a chance to not have it. Because once it's in the water system, the only way to get it out is to have a very expensive filtration system. So it's sort of a matter of, is it safe, and a matter of choice. So what I've been doing is trying to now, since this bill, at least at this time, isn't going to be enacted or amended or whatever, I'm forced to come up with my own ordinance that will work for our district under the constraints that I have with our board members. And what I'm doing is basically developing a program that involves dentists and doctors who have to prescribe the fluoride, pharmaceutical grade fluoride that you will buy at the store that has been screened for the arsenic and lead. We have to get a prescription from them. Then the parents have to decide whether they want their children to have it or not. And then I have to put together a payment program that's subsidized by the district, so the families that are underprivileged have access to it. And I'm trying to now put this program together so at least the people that want fluoridation and don't have the money for it and do feel that there is a medical benefit, at least get it in a dosage that's reasonable and that the rest of the community that doesn't want it isn't forced to use it. And so that's what I'm having to do, in contrast to being able to have a bill such as 684 to rely on. Now, I've sort of ran through my talking points that I've submitted here, and I just don't know how far to go in detail about the situation. I mean, I can say, for example, I've had experience at the drugstore. Let's say my child, I want fluoridation for my child. I'm in a part of the district that doesn't get fluoride. So I go to the drugstore and say, can I buy fluoride tablets? And they say, no, you have to have your dentist or your doctor write a prescription. And I said, but how come the other part of the district gets fluoride and they don't have a prescription? So there's real inconsistencies in the dispensing of fluoride, even within our own district. And in contrast, the district, they're, because of a vote back in 1960 and a lack of regulation, they are dispensing fluoride for a medical purpose to help prevent tooth decay without prescriptions, without doctor's recommendations, and there's no dose requirement in that particular application because you cannot do it because each child is going to drink a different amount of water mm-hmm. at a different age. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I know I'm jumping around a little bit,
but I'm trying to
give you an overview.
I think what you are doing is excellent. I think you've covered the main points, and what I would rather do now is hear some other ideas that you can respond to, because I think you've done just what you is proper. You're setting the broad parameters, and you're not arguing, and you're not saying fluoride should necessarily be removed. You're saying that it should be tested by the FDA, and fluoride itself under some forms is okay, under some forms isn't, and you're concerned about other elements in the water that people get with the fluoride, and you don't have a problem, and I don't think, with local control. You would like some standards, and there are several things that need to be discussed based on what you said, but I think you've set the parameters. And now what I would like to do is invite Dr. Tenpas to come up, and you can move over and stay there at the table if you want to, and or just stay where you are, and then you'll have an opportunity to respond, because I think that way that would. Yes.
I just had one quick question.
Sure.
Or of staff, mm-hmm. and that is, Dr. Bates has written a letter, mm-hmm. and there's this paperclip. Does this mean that Dr. Bates?
He's one of many in that packet.
All right. But he didn't collect all these. You did.
No.
Okay, so.
Lee Campbell provided those to us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess what I would like to do in just a moment to kind of shed some light on this, the chief co-sponsor, Senator Shields, is a chief co-sponsor, along with Representative Patridge. You have a Democratic Senator, Republican representative. You also have Senators Atkinson, Senator, who's a Republican, Senator George, Republican, Senator Burdick, who's a Democrat, Senator Walker, who
just walked out,
is a Democrat. You have Representative Bates, Representative Posansky, Representative Rosenbaum, all of whom are Democrats. So, this is a bipartisan bill. So we're not, we're not dealing in that political arena. And I felt, I want to set the record straight, too. I felt a little bit resistant to even having a hearing, because I knew if we had an open public hearing, we would go on for 3 days, people from both sides. I thought it was important, however, to frame the issue, and then to decide where we want to go, because you certainly have some proponents of doing this. Now, what it is we're going to do, FDA, I don't know. Why haven't they spoken already? That's a question. What has prevented them from jumping in and saying, hey, you got to separate all of those trace minerals from the fluoride? That's a lead into your discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. Bill Tenpas. I'm a dentist. My background is I work with the DCOs in the state. I am past president of the American Dental Association, past president of the Oregon Dental Association, past president of the Oregon Academy of General Dentistry. I was a school board member and chair of the school board, so I see what happens in the schools when kids are not screened properly or do not get the proper prevention. I'm a parent and also a user of fluoride for years. I grew up in a town that fluoridated. In my family, there were six children. The first four had not had the benefits of fluoride, and the following two had the benefits of fluoride. The four that didn't have the benefits had extensive restorations in their mouth. The two that had benefits of fluoride have no restorations in their mouth. It is proven the Centers for Disease Control have backed. They have said that fluoride is one of the 10 top preventive measures in the United States ever. C. Everett Koop has said this is a preventive measure that is second to none in oral health. So I want to go over a little bit about some of the things that I see in both a professional role as a dentist and also as a personal. First of all, there's somebody in the room that can discuss the issues of the quality of the fluoride that's put in the water. That's an engineering and how it's put in the water and the costs. And David Liebland, who's an expert on engineering, and he's from the drinking water section of the Oregon Public Health Service, is here to talk with you. The discussion on the quality of fluoride in the water, pharmaceutical versus industrial grade, is, in my estimation, a smokescreen. There is not industrial. There's ANSI standards for the fluoride used. There is a standard for how it is engineered and put into the water. And that gentleman can probably answer your more technical questions. The issue of fluoridation as far as a prescription versus water, let's address that right now. The concentration in prescriptions is much greater than what is in the water. And so that's why it is regulated like that. It's one part per million in the water that is the beneficial. There are many areas of the United States where fluoride is naturally occurring mineral in the water. So it is not something that is a poison or anything along those lines. My professional experience, I have found that fluoride is best recognized as a medicament for the innocents of the world. Those people that cannot afford to go get a fluoride prescription, those people who do not have the opportunity of access or money or whatever to dental care, not just the young, but the elderly, in nursing homes, in areas where we've had great successes in maintaining their teeth their entire life now versus dentures. And suddenly now we're noticing that we need to have extra prevention for the root decay and stuff like that is happening in older age. Fluoride gives us that ability to do that.
Senator Minnis.
Yes, Doctor, excuse me.
Help me understand this.
Okay.
You're a clinician.
Uh-huh.
We have a problem with mental health in the United States.
Yes.
So why wouldn't we lace our water with lithium or some other antidepressant? And, you know, I guess what I'm trying to get to is someone in medical science or in the sciences decides that it's an appropriate social policy to lace the water with fluoride because there's a broader public purpose. Well, why wouldn't you do that with mental health drugs or lithium or some other compound that you know can safely be, you know, mixed with water that might make everybody more calm? And it may sound ridiculous, but there is actually a community in, I believe, Arizona that actually discussed the idea. And so it's kind of like, what point does it get ridiculous where science steps in and says to the public, this is in your best interest. So we're going to mix a little bit of this here and a little bit of that there, and suddenly sure. We're going to have people with great teeth and good attitudes.
Well, I think you have a good point, and I think that the bill addresses not only fluoride, but other additives. And we've provided you with a notebook that discusses what all those other additives are. So let's get to your question on lithium. First of all, the dosage of lithium is much more difficult to regulate than the dosage.
Well, I really wasn't concerned more about the lithium or the dosage. I'm concerned about the policy.
The public health policy.
The public health policy, the social engineering that goes along with a mixture of science, and somebody substituting their professional judgment for the judgment of an individual who might choose or not choose to have those particular compounds invested in their water supply. Who's the superior power here?
I guess the superior power has to do with the benefit versus the difficulty of it, and that's a ratio. And I think the benefit to the majority, much like many of the things we do in our democracy, has to do with the benefits of the total population versus the interests of a small minority in limiting it their way, and what it would take then to get that maximum benefit for those that have no other ability to gain it otherwise. So I think that that's the way. I mean, it's certainly like we make laws as far as demonstrations, we make laws as far as other things to make it for the public good.
But we don't make laws, at least I don't think we should, where we force people knowingly or unknowingly to ingest compounds into the body because there's some higher public good. It's like there are philosophical viewpoints that would choose that certain elderly people or certain disabled people or individuals that have certain behavioral patterns might not be worthy of living.
Well, I think now, we're skewing this off the issue of fluoride and onto an issue of...
It's taking you back to the fundamental question, when is it appropriate for the government to step in and say this is an appropriate step on behalf of your government to choose?
I think it's when we say that the majority of the population benefit and the difficulties with addition of that does not negatively affect the minority.
In whose opinion?
Well, I guess you have to go by the existing research that's out there, since there is no...
Again, it's a substituted judgment question. You have a group of scientists who are saying our judgment is more superior to yours.
No, they don't say their judgment is more superior than theirs. They say their research has shown. I think that's a little different than saying our judgment. It says they're juried research that is readily definable.
Well, are you suggesting there's not a controversy among clinicians or scientists regarding this whole issue?
There's a controversy about many issues out
there.
Exactly
my point.
But I think that this controversy is based not on good science, and good science from on down.
It's a judgment question. You've got groups of science on each side of these issues.
Okay, let me enter.
May I finish my...
No, yes, you may finish. But what I would like to say that I think the reason that there's a discussion of fluoride in the water is because there are places where there's natural fluoride in the water. So there is a leap from there's natural fluoride, it's good for your teeth, therefore if we put fluoride in, it'll be good for your teeth. And so they started from that premise.
There's iron in your water.
There's
so
iron in your water.
It doesn't mean you add iron,
okay.
Iron or sulfur to your water.
Okay, let's go ahead and finish your testimony and then we will discuss and question. Yeah, finish your
okay.
Testimony.
Yeah. One part per million of the water is a level that is more than safe. What it does is it makes the tooth harder so that it is less susceptible to the bacteria that releases an acid that causes decay.
Okay.
I think the science is very clear on this. The CDC, the National Institute of Health, all of those have done research that has been juried, that has been readily demonstrable that this can be replicated, that this is a safe substance to use.
Okay. Now, should the Food and Drug Administration play a role also? Because that's,
well, I think EPA deals with drinking water, and I think they have turned that over to a group, and in your book I have that group that has asked them to do the standard. The American Water Works Association set standards for all chemicals used in water treatment plants, including fluoride chemicals, mm-hmm. And this is the group the EPA has asked to regulate those issues. So in your book I have this issue and stuff addressed.
What I'm trying to do is clarify the testimony that you're giving,
sure.
Because we don't have a lot of time to go into the great detail that you've given us. So you say that rather than the Food and Drug Administration, there is another governmental department that is doing that. Now you can respond to that in a moment if you wish. Go ahead and continue your testimony so we can have something to respond to.
Okay. I think what we have to look here is this a minority group that is trying to decide what safe water is without the ability to define what safe water is. When we have municipal water systems, there have to be certain standards as far as the chlorine they put in there, as far as other things. To say that everybody should get, there should be nothing added to this water, we would have an awful lot of people drinking water that is unsafe. And so we then go to the issue of...
Yes, Senator Mendez.
I just, you know, give me a break. You put chlorine in water to kill certain kinds of microbes and different organisms that can kill you. You don't it's just the opposite policy of adding things that we think are going to make you healthy.
You look at that.
You understand what I'm saying? I mean, water standing in the sunshine by, you know, the mere drifting of certain kinds of materials is going to create all kinds of bizarre things that we don't want in our water. It's what we don't want in our water that can kill us. But shouldn't that logic apply to somebody from the...
Senator, we respectfully disagree on this one. I respectfully disagree with you. I think that you raise a
you're
point.
You're from the government, and you're here to help us.
No, sir, I'm not here from the government. I am a private practitioner.
Time out. In all fairness and due respect to our two invited guests, we are only going to have invited testimony.
And the committee can't talk. Okay.
Oh, no, excuse me. I don't mean to say that, but we do want to have the questions, but I do want to give them a chance to make their very limited presentation because we're going to run out of time in a little while. And
well, Mr. Chair, I have a question. When can I ask it?
Well, as a chief co-sponsor of the bill, I guess I... You're not going
to
leave.
I have to meet with the speaker.
Oh.
We'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, Doctor, you're a dentist, correct?
That's correct.
Why can't you just put the darn stuff on their teeth instead of putting it in my drinking water?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons we can't do that. We can do that in the office if, one, people have access to a dentist.
Yeah.
Number two, if they can afford to have it. Number three, if we can get the children into the office. And so that access also, we deal with economic access, we deal with ethnic access, we deal with phobic access. All of those things affect the people that come into the office. So those things limit how we can apply that fluoridation. And so you can, it's one, some people can't afford it. Should they be denied it? Second of all, many people that are Hispanic and others, it's very difficult when we talk with them and stuff to get them into offices to get the dental care that they need. We have a program in Corvallis in which we have a immersion school, a Spanish immersion school, which has helped a great deal in educating them on the culture of dental care and those sorts of things. Elderly, just the ability to get from place A to place B, from a assisted living or nursing home into a facility to apply those substances is difficult for some.
Okay, second question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Okay, you've told me all these reasons why people don't go to the dentist and they can't have access to it, but if I recall correctly, almost every tube of toothpaste on the store shelf, unless you buy toothpaste like I do, which doesn't have fluoride, has fluoride in it. So then not only do you get it in your toothpaste when you brush your teeth, and don't tell me that people don't brush their teeth. I'm sure that they do it at least twice a day. They should do it three times a day, but I'm sure people brush their teeth at least twice a day. Twice a day, 365 days a year, isn't that enough fluoride?
Senator, I would love to have you in my office for one day to see people that don't brush their teeth even once every other day.
Oh, gross.
And so that aspect. The second aspect is the use of fluoride. Fluoride is a topical substance that must remain on the surface of the tooth. Many times when you brush your teeth and then you rinse your mouth out, you lose much of the efficacy of the fluoride. So in that respect, it's difficult. Whereas when it's in water...
Excuse me, Doctor, why do they put it in toothpaste then if it's not going to do any good? Your argument...
No, I'm not saying it doesn't do any good. I'm saying that it has limited ability, much different than the fluoride. One, they also, if you look at the tube of toothpaste, it says, please do not ingest or swallow. But so that eliminates some of the systemic effects of the fluoride that is very beneficial for the patient.
Do not ingest or swallow. Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. He keeps raising questions for me. Do not ingest or swallow.
Mm-hmm.
So the toothpaste companies that have fluoride say do not ingest or swallow, yet you want to put that stuff in my drinking water.
No. I didn't say it was the fluoride that they the reason you don't ingest or swallow.
Because everything
toothpaste
else
is a natural emetic, which means it makes you gag, and it's not something that they want you to take in large doses of swallow. It's not because of the fluoride they don't want to ingest or swallow. I think that's a leap of faith to assume one
now
is the other.
I'll stop my questions. Thank you.
I will reiterate that I think it is important that we hear each side We may have questions. We have our own philosophical bent on this. There are three members of this committee, maybe four, maybe five, who, I don't know. We're not going to have a work session. We want to hear the testimony, and if this has legs, it will move into maybe an interim study and be back next session, but we are setting the groundwork, so please continue.
Okay. Getting to the interim study, I would ask, before you authorize an interim study and spend the state's money, you look at the studies that are out there, and there are numerous, and I can certainly, there are many references here. We can certainly give you this. We can get you the CDC. We can get you the National Institute of Health. We can give you all of those studies to at least look at before you determine that it needs to be relooked at again as far as going through those studies, because the amount of evidence is staggering in the benefit of this. And so we would love to give you that information and let somebody say, do we really need a committee to study something that has been so dramatically studied in the years past?
Well, I guess,
that's the end of mine, sir.
My recommendation as a chair only would that this issue be looked at either in a interim committee, but my recommendation has absolutely no weight to have that done. But I think I wanted to have the hearing. There have been a lot of pressure on both sides to have the hearing. This may set the tone for other things that may come up. Either way, did you have some responses?
I can comment in general. I don't pretend to be the expert. I'm a decision maker, and I'm trying to learn as much as I can and go through the due diligence. But the very fact that we're having this exchange tells me that there's a lot of fleshing out that needs to be done in this issue. And
no pun intended.
And during that process, then you can get the toxicologists, the dentists, the doctors, the orthopedics in to testify and hear what they all have to say. So depending on what comes out of this, we have gone through and done our due diligence. And that is what I'm most concerned about, is that I don't just make a decision based on an endorsement by the American Dental Association or the American Medical Association. I want to go through, read the studies, which a lot of them I have had the chance to do, and to go through that due diligence before I do make a decision. The problem is when I go through and look at those endorsements and I ask for the toxicological studies to support them, there are none. That's what I'm having problems with. As far as, for instance, I've made a few notes here, but for example, the approval process for fluoride, I'm trying to keep in the broad picture, not to focus in. But, for instance, the American Water Works Association, they sent the standards for the dosage, just one part per million. Well, in our district, that varies from 0.7 up to 1.6, depending on the time of year and how the equipment is working. But as it turns out, that Cargill, who manufactures 70% of the fluoride products for the nation, is on the advisory board for the AWWA. So we have, from my information, we have the people that are selling the product on the board that's recommending the dosage of this one part per million. And that, to me, doesn't sound right. And then I'm going to make two quotes here that really, I think, hit home. And if I didn't do it, Lynn Campbell would just hang me. One is a letter to the, and I'm not going to read the whole letter, but one letter is from the FDA, and it says, fluoride, when used in the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of a disease in man or animal, is a drug that is subject to FDA regulation. Fluoride is not regulated by the FDA, but it is used as a medication. Secondly, there's a letter from the EPA, and by the way, that was a December 21st, 2000 letter to the Honorable Ken Calvert, Chairman of the Subcommittee on Energy and Environment, which is probably in your packet, and you can read it in its fullness. Here is another letter from the Environmental Protection Agency asking, there's been a question asked of the EPA of whether you've studied or approved or seen the effectiveness of the safety of fluoride. To answer your question on whether we have in our possession scientific data on the effects of fluoride, fluoracetic acid or sodium silico fluoride on health and behavior, our answer is no. They have no studies. They haven't done studies. They don't have any from the rest of the world in their possession that show that it is safe and effective.
Okay. Senator Fisher.
Yeah. Mr. Martin. Do we have a state law that requires fluoride in water?
No.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do we have any state agencies running water businesses or water purifying systems that are furnishing water to the public run by the state that putting fluoride in it or even being run by the state?
To my knowledge, no. They're all locally controlled water districts that make their own decision.
Mr. Chair. We've had several attempts around the state, if I'm not wrong, to do fluoride in the water. It's been discussed pro and con, and the people have voted some up, some down. Is that not right?
That's true, and it's an ongoing process as the publicity of the issue raises.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does not every local authority that has any type of water quality or water type business or part in putting water out for the public have a constituency?
That's true.
Does not that constituency have a right to demand what their water content is?
They have that right, and that's as an elected official, that's my...
Mr. Chair, follow up. Are we not trying to preserve as much local control as we possibly can?
That is, as far as I know, that is the idea, and that's why we have individual districts representing certain people.
Mr. Chair, I've got a whole box of due diligence. We went through this 2 years ago from A to Z. I've kept the box. It's the only bill that I kept from the 2001 session. And I'm willing to donate it to anybody. It's a local issue. There isn't one local group in this state that doesn't have the right to go to the voting booth and take this to the people. So why in the world are we sitting here fooling around, wasting our time, time after time after time, over something that you can't prove, and maybe somebody else can't prove it either?
Well, I can respond to that, Senator. The problem is that each municipality or each district is generally governed by either a board or a city council. They will evaluate this, for instance, box of information, and one board in one period of time may evaluate it one way, and another board the next year after a new vote may evaluate it, and so what you would have is inconsistency spread across the state. I think what the bill is trying to do is to get some consistency so all of these boards and municipality councils can rely on something uniform, so they're not guessing, should we go this way, should we go that way, should we interpret the information this way, should we interpret it that way.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If this is as serious a problem as you seem to consider it, then why do you have any problem whatsoever convincing any locality to vote it out of your program and get it out of your water? It's a pretty simple matter. Board's not going to continue to put it back in and take it out and put it back in and take it out. If they're told by the community to keep it out, they're going to keep it out.
Well, what you're saying does have merit. The problem is that during that process of voting, the people generally are relying on their board for recommendations because they don't have the time and the ability to do the research that's necessary to really make an informed decision. I'm not saying that the people, the customers are not able to make a decision and that they shouldn't be involved with that, but they do need the information before they make that decision.
Senator Fisher.
Mr. Chair, having witnessed a couple of different attempts to fluoride water, there's no particular problem in my way of thinking. I don't think the people in the Sutherland and Roseburg area are any smarter than anybody else. They didn't have any trouble voting it down. Apparently they didn't want it. I don't think they're any different than any other group in the state. And from the standpoint that I come from, where I've looked into thousands and thousands of mouths, that one of my military buddies described as looking like the bottom of a bird cage, and he wasn't far off. And I'll back up the fact that it's not a matter of seeing somebody that hasn't seen a toothbrush in once a week. It's a matter of somebody that's 18, 20 years old coming in the military that's never seen one in his life. I've watched dentists put gentian violet on people's teeth and tell them to get out of the chair and go when they brush that off to come back and they'd work on them. They wouldn't even work on them. They were so lousy. So, you know, a little fluoride couldn't possibly hurt a situation like that when you sit there and you have a dentist that's pulling 200 teeth a day out of kids that are 18, 20 years old. You know, you got to try to do something. And so my feeling is that this is a local issue. The state doesn't have any particular business doing in it. And you guys come in here with a bill that has tried to be disguised, came into my office, tried to present it as something that was such a great idea when basically it was an anti-fluoride thing on two different legs. And, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. There's less than 25% of the people in this state that are getting fluoridated water right now. And if it was all that bad and they didn't want it that bad, they could take it out of their water tomorrow.
Okay. Senator Walker, did you have another question, statement? Winding it down.
Well, I think I appreciate Senator Fisher's views, and it may be a local issue, Mr. Chair, but I think I was looking at the bill here, for the purpose for which it is added by the United States Food and Drug Administration, the issue here is that the FDA doesn't have any, has done nothing to put its stamp of approval on fluoride. Doesn't say that it's an okay thing to be used, and it's a drug that's put in our water. I remember the movie Soylent Green. Every time I think of that, I think of fluoride. But, you know, be it that as it may, I would remind the doctor that if we put this over to an interim study, it doesn't cost the taxpayers money. It's just part of the something that the committee would review, and Senator Fisher obviously has a whole box of material that's at our ready reference, but I don't think it requires the legislature spending money on studies. It's simply a policy matter, and we look at the studies that are available and examine the issue and decide whether we want to come back next session. So, and I think that's what we're here for.
Senator. Now, what I would add to that is that what you've accomplished by this very brief hearing is you did put together a new packet of material that you have distributed that will, and you do obviously, you do have some proponents of this bill. There are some opponents of it. I think, you know, this is an unending argument. I'm not sure at what point there will be a definitive statement or decision made. It is a local issue in many ways, but what I see you asking for, though, is some kind of guideline that the decision can be based on. I think that's what you're asking for.
Right.
Now, you're saying there are already those guidelines.
That's
you're
correct,
saying
sir.
That they're not the right ones because this is should come under the category of a drug or, you know. So I can understand your argument. I understand it. And I think you're clarifying that argument by what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
This will continue, this discussion. I don't know if anything else is going to happen this legislative interim. I can say that I would like to see it studied in an interim committee. I don't know if we're even going to have an interim committee. And if we do have one, then the agenda will come up, and I would suppose if you wanted to get on the agenda, it would be up to you then to come back and say, we want this looked at.
I might mention while you're looking there.
Senator Starr has not had an opportunity to speak, and he has a committee meeting coming up.
I do, and I need to get away
yes.
quite quickly. But I
I'm a strong opponent of this proposed legislation. I side largely with Senator Fisher. My testimony, though, goes to the fact of natural fluoridation. I was born and raised in an area where there was such. My father died 2 weeks ago this morning at the age of 92 with all of his teeth. I saw a dentist 3 times before I was 55 years of age. Fluoridation is good for dental, for bones. There are a few alarmists out there who brought this issue forward. It has nothing to do with good health. I'm sorry that it's here. Thank you.
You're leaving. And Mr. Chair, you will soon have your box to carry with you.
Could I make one comment before we close down here? I feel a real responsibility as a water provider to my customers, and it's a safety issue for me. If I knew that the FDA had tested and approved this drug, I would put it in, and if it was effective, I would put it in the water myself. But until it is approved by the FDA, I have strong reluctance. And many of the people that I've talked to who are pro-fluoridation, they do not know that the FDA has not approved it. And once they find that out, they're relying on the government, in this case, to protect them. And that hasn't taken place. And so I'm here as a water provider trying to do what's right for my customers and their safety. And if I knew that it had been approved and tested, I wouldn't have a problem with putting it in, because there's clearly some evidence that shows that it works. But it hasn't gone through that, in my view, as a water provider, has not gone through the proper approval and testing process by the FDA.
Now, Senator, may I have something to say? I've sort of stayed quiet on that issue. Okay. The FDA does look at fluoride. It's in medications. It's in the PDR, which is the handbook for physicians and dentists to look at when they prescribe medications. To say that the FDA has not looked at fluoride is irresponsible and wrong. They do not look at it. The EPA deals with the water issue. The FDA deals with devices, medical devices, and medicaments. And there's a difference there. And that's where I'll end. Thank you very much, sir.
Now, you can see why, okay, we have a very divided committee. This bill would not get out of committee. I don't know if this bill right now would pass out of the legislature. I don't know if the governor, what the governor would do. It is a very important question for different reasons for different groups. So I guess I'm maybe in the unfortunate position where I'm kind of in the middle, because I can understand what you're asking for is some guidelines, some verification. Now, you're saying it's already there. I think fluoride has been proven effective in a natural state and in medication. Is it not only ineffective, but possibly harmful if it's added along with other traits, elements, and so on? That's an important question. And when you look at the sponsors of the bill, again, you see some very intelligent, informed legislators who have strong feelings about the bill. But you also, on the other side, have very intelligent, informed people who are opposed. So I've done the best I can to give you an opportunity to exchange views and do what you think needs to be done. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the time that you've taken to hear us. Thank you very much.
So we will close the public hearing and close the session.
The session?